caller. Hello?
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice again.
All right. Well, this week on the podcast, I got a question from a listener. And usually we go through the questions, you know, in the order they're received, unless they've been answered already. But this one I got recently, so I wanted to put it on because it really struck me as someone who's kind of in a tough spot. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Lyle, it came to my attention last week that my college-age daughter is anorexic. She will be starting counseling tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I also follow Chef AJ, and she suggested that before that to get your advice on how to handle this. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to proceed or the best way to proceed. I found a therapist where disordered eating is her primary area of focus, but I don't want to do more harm. What say you?
Yeah, good. I'm glad that that's what she did. And so hopefully hopefully we're in the hands of someone who is experienced in this problem. And we'll see how it goes. I mean, these are very, very difficult problems. There's only one thing that I would advise this person to do, which is to I guess it would be the following. I would have a question and then advice, and that is that I would want to know a lot of people that. So if this person has been talking to Chef AJ, then this individual is very in what I'm going to call the hyper health arena. And so obviously, in other words, super concerned about food and health and how those two are related, et cetera. Now, if the daughter is also of that persuasion, then this is important because the therapist may consider that the daughter's concern about food and food's health and what's legal and not legal for her to eat is, quote, part of her problem, which is not true. So that's a major misconception. They've invented a name for it, orthorexia. I would recommend this individual to email me if that's what your daughter's orientation is. If your daughter's orientation is not that, if your daughter is a reasonably conventional eater, maybe somewhat health oriented, but not that health oriented, really, doesn't worry that too much about the specific foods and their relation to health, worries more about the calories and so on and so forth, and that's sort of her deal, then we don't worry about it. The one thing that we don't want is we don't want a bright, hyper-conscientious, which anorexic folks are hyper-conscientious, person that also is aware of the issues around healthy food choices. We don't want that person battling their therapist and having an additional issue of essentially pressure being brought to bear on them that, quote, their, quote, orthorexia is, quote, part of their problem. If that's the case, then unfortunately the therapist needs to be educated, and the therapist could be educated by that parent. Worst case scenario, the therapist is educated by me. Okay, so some space needs to be cleared in that therapist's head for the possibility that the therapist doesn't know a damn thing about food and health, which they almost certainly don't. So I've never met an eating distorted psychotherapist specialist that knew anything about health and food. They all think they do, and they don't know anything. So and that's a problem, because once in a blue moon, you get one of these anorexic young people that are smart and aware and have been exposed to the right information about food, and now they've got a two-front war that they're having to fight. They're having to fight anorexia, and they're having to fight the people arguing with them about about their position with respect to what's healthy food and what isn't healthy food, and what one's approach to food should be. So the Alan Goldhammer would be diagnosed as orthorexia. I would be diagnosed as orthorexia. Nate would be diagnosed as orthorexia. Damn near everybody I hang out with would be diagnosed with this. And not a single one of us has any psychological problems with food at all, obviously. So this is so that is my only warning. If the daughter does not have any issues like this, in other words, if she's not hyper and ridiculously educated and fastidious about these issues, if she's reasonably in anywhere near the bell curve with respect to these issues, and what we're dealing with is straight anorexia, then no problem. We leave that therapist alone. Okay. So that's so that person can email me about this issues and that information if they need sort of further support and information.
Fantastic.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're going to change topics quite a bit now and talk about paternity testing.
Okay.
So, Dr. Lyle, I'm about to become a father, and I feel like I won't get a single night's sleep until a DNA test gets done. Of course, I haven't brought it up with the mother, because I feel like it's a huge nest of hornets. Is this a reasonable request to make sure, or just a huge signal of distrust? It sounds like we're, hyper conscientiousness on both sides, the anorexia now, the paternity testing. So there's the theme right there.
Very interesting. Sort of a question of the ages, I would suppose. It certainly is a signal of distrust, and there's so many questions about, obviously, the nature of that relationship, its history, et cetera, that would feed into this issue, and so questions that I can't ask, et cetera. But just as a my general strategy of decision making is, we never make a big decision when a small decision will do. So if this person is about to become a father, they can just have a few sleepless nights. Let's have the child born, and let's look at, let's learn a little bit about Mendelian genetics here. Blood types, eye color, stuff like this, okay? So if it turns out that the kid's hair color, eye color, and blood test are an impossible match for you, then guess what? Then we got reason to ask for a DNA test. You might want to make a small decision here first, and look at some sort of the cues of the ages. Now, then I'd have to think that one through. I'm not even sure what I would do about that. Let's do that first, and let's see how that goes. And then after that, this person can write to me, and we will plot. there's a way to have those conversations with that individual, and the general strategy that we would use if we have to go there would be that, hey, I'm an obsessive nutcase. I can't help it. I've been all wrapped around the behavior genetics wacky crap on the Beat Your Genes podcast, okay? And now it's got to be in my bonnet, and I'm really sorry, but I just can't shut it off for some reason. It's just an open loop. Would you mind terribly if we had a DNA test? That's how that's how I would do that. In other words, you do that one on your belly. Again, the general strategy is I'm the nut. Okay, this is because I'm a nut. It's not because of any other reason. That's how we would do it. But first, let's look at those eyes. Okay. All right.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it reminds me of a question we have in the queue, but it has to do with Jeffrey Miller, who apparently is considering writing a book about polyamory, since he says, about 5 to 15% of people today practice open relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is kind of on that same, is that if people want to cheat in their marriage, is there a way to go about doing that in a good way? And the question the listener is asking, is pornography the only way to scratch such an itch if someone wants to stay married to their partner?
I would say this, that that's kind of a big and interesting question. And I would be very interested in anything that Miller would write on this topic. He's a very, very bright human who has, I'm sure, thought a great deal about these issues. He's been obsessed with sex at an intelligent level for as long as I've been obsessed with sex from a practical level. Okay, so he's about as deep as they come in this area. I would say that once again, in trying to solve practical issues, that we make the smallest possible decisions. What we're discussing here is there's a broader principle involved here, and that's the principle of identity. So if you think about what you are, more or less who you are is your brain. You are not really your toes, and we're not the scar on your knee, and we're not the haywire little finger that you got broken, skiing. Okay, that's not you. You are your brain. And that brain has in it circuits for feelings. And those feelings are involuntary responses that happen as a result of things that are happening to you. So our job in this life is to try to figure out how to activate the feelings we want and to not activate the feelings that we don't want. And broad classification of those are the moods of happiness versus the moods of unhappiness. That's very sloppy, because there's happiness, there's pleasure. Those are two kind of different things, but they can certainly co-occur. There's also pain responses, pain feelings too. But what we're really talking about here, when we don't, we're going to get untechnical. We're just talking about, good feelings versus bad feelings. And swirling around in this is the fact that good feelings result from evolutionarily successful type feedback. And evolutionary processes are generally competitive. And so as a result, evolutionarily positive processes involve conflicts of interest between individuals. And so as a result, somebody's good feeling is somebody else's not so good feeling. Not always. There's a lot of games that are non-zero sum. But there are many games that are zero sum. And there's winners and losers, and there are if you have a pair bond, and let's say in an extremely stereotypical situation, let's suppose that we have a female who is pair bonded to a male, and is not adventurous in her psychology sexually, and she's perfectly happy with this one guy for the whole rest of the ride, that she met at 35. And let's suppose stereotypically that the guy is not quite so happy And so as a result, he has the genes of the typical male. He has the machinery that was built by the genes that cause him to have the psychology of what I call wife, chippy, which is that when you do a log linear plot on the testicle size of a primate relative to its body weight, you can predict how many sex partners that primary mate has within a short length of time in its life at any one given time of its life during the course of the evolution of that species. So if it's a small testicled primate, then it's likely to be a pair bonding male who rarely, has periodic sex with one female and is not under intense sperm competition with other males, trying to get as much sperm as it can into as many females as it can. If you have a species where there is not pair bonding, where the male's job is not to, try to display that it will care for offspring and invest in offspring, the male's job is actually to get as much of its sperm as it can into as many females as it can, then it's going to have very big testicles. And so the chimpanzee has phenomenally sized testicles, and the average chimpanzee male has sex 8 times a day for its lifetime. Don't get excited, Nate. You've evolved a little bit from the chimp. not too far. Now, on the other side of this, of course, if a male is having sex 8 times a day, then a female is having sex 8 times a day. And so a chimpanzee troop is astonishingly carnal, and as you would expect. And so it's a swirling cauldron of sexuality. The sex doesn't take very long. It's just a very, very rapid process. So they don't make a big fuss about it the way humans do. But at any rate, that's how that works. It's a tremendous sperm competition. Now, where was I in all this? So it's going to turn out that humans are somewhere in the middle of this mess. So they are clearly not a small testicle pair bond species. They are clearly not a wildly promiscuous sperm competition species, where that's a predominant issue. They do have aspects of both. They're in the middle. And so we would expect that if we were to guess the average psychology of the average member of the species, and we're talking heading right to the middle of the bell curve on male and female psychology, we would expect that the female would be quite a bit more conservative sexually than the male, and that she would be the average female under average circumstances would be pretty okay with this guy that was acceptable, and as long as he's protecting and providing and hasn't deteriorated or defrauded her about who it is that he was, he remains acceptable, potentially indefinitely. The male would not have such apparatus on average. Smack dab in the middle of the male bell curve for psychology on this issue, you have what I call wife, chippy. I actually remember this, the data, I read this somewhere in a book by Edward O. Wilson, and I don't know what book and when. I can't remember whether it was wife, chippy or wife, chippy. My memory is that it's wife, chippy. This is my terms, by the way, folks. And it's the notion that I believe the average male across the history of the species had 1.3 sex partners at any one point in their life. So that, what does that mean? That means that they had a steady sex partner, and then about once in a while they had a chippy on the side. That's not what's happening today, because in any one given generation, only the most successful men are having that happen, and a whole bunch of other men are not having that happen. But you don't come from the average male in the course of human evolution. You come from the average successful male throughout the course of the history of evolution. And so that's what those people did. So sitting inside the head of the average male, who the average male cannot pull this off typically, but the average male would like to pull it off. His psychological machinery is wife, 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 chippy. I've had people in my office sweating their marriage vows, males, and they really love the person that they're with. But they're also have been experienced enough to know, you know, these aren't 22 years old. These are 37 years old. And they've been around the block a while. They've had some relationships. They might have been married before. And they're looking at this situation, and they're starting to get cold feet. And the cold feet is when I explained this to them. I said, how would it be if, you know, two, three times a year you could satisfy that chippy urge? And the response is, oh my God, if I could just have that, no problem with the rest of the commitment problem.
Wow. Okay? As the wife stares daggers at you.
No, believe me, the wife's nowhere in sight. This is like, this is like deep. I have a special cavern in my office. It's three stories down under the granite. Nobody can hear. Okay. Steel door. This is Maxwell Smart in the cone of silence. Okay. Yeah. In the cone of silence, this is what it comes down to. Okay. And you know, this is exactly what Miller's talking about. And it's not like it's only men wearing the black hats and women being naive. Obviously there's these genes get thrown around the landscape, but this is going to be more common inside the male's brain than it's going to be in the female's brain. So what does this mean? This means we have conflicts of interest, folks. And these conflicts of interest and what the world is slowly struggling with and attempting to do, excuse me, is to try to get wiser about this and attempting to try to figure out how can we better negotiate these natural conflicts of interest, and how can we optimize the moods of happiness for all individuals involved? And now, in the book Sex at Dawn, the authors will conclude that there's no reason for the females to be upset about this, and that, you know, that essentially we're socialized into thinking that sort of cheating and promiscuous behavior is just a negative thing. It doesn't have to be at all. These people are completely naive. I think this was, can't remember his name, Chris something and his wife.
Chris Ryan.
Chris Ryan. Yeah, this is ridiculous. This is Chris Ryan being heavily influenced by cultural anthropology. I think that's probably his main education. Apparently can't get it through his thick skull. He obviously has been educated in, to some degree, in biological anthropology, not very well, but he certainly does not deeply grasp and understand evolutionary psychology. He doesn't understand human evolution. So it's very clear that there are jealousy systems that are built into both male and female humans, and these are not the result of cultural, you know, enculturation. That is ridiculous. It's completely insane. If that were true, you would theoretically find cultures there where there would be no such thing as romantic love and no such thing as sexual jealousy. Do you understand that? If there's romantic love, then there is a bonding around sexual exclusivity, and there's a threat to that exclusivity, et cetera, that activates jealousy mechanisms. You can't consider something extremely important and want it a lot and then want to just give it away. That's not how this works. So there, in this game, we cannot just say, oh, the cultural norms have created an artificial conflict of interest. No, they have not created an artificial conflict of interest. they may have added trouble along financial lines, cultural expectations, fancy thing called a marriage, you know, problems with provisioning of children into very, you know, huge long time child provisioning, et cetera. There's an awful lot of things that have added a tremendous amount of pressure and essentially had people facing the problem of making a 50-year decision with a chip that was designed to do it for 5 years. So the so there is, you know, smart humans are trying to finally face the realities of this problem, and they're struggling. They're struggling with it. It's interesting. Miller's saying 5 to 15%. That's quite a range of estimates. It means that somebody's got a survey in, you know, one magazine that's saying it's 15%. Gee, I wonder what those magazines are. And somebody else has got a survey in another magazine that says 5%, and that magazine looks a little different. 15% of people practicing open relationships, I don't know what those relationships are, but let's talk about people that have been, like, married for 3 years, i.e. not people that have just flaked out on this thing and didn't take it seriously. You telling me there's 15% of married couples in the United States are practicing open relationships? There's no way in hell that's true. Not even close. So this is that's wishful thinking on somebody's part. No, this is down more probably along the lines of 5%, maybe. And it's pretty rare, which tells us that it's not that palatable for humans. And it means that the people that are doing this are people that are inherently pretty open. Somebody's probably disagreeable, you know what I mean, and going to push their agenda within the potential conflicts of interest that this would activate inside that relationship, et cetera. Now, is it a good thing, bad thing? You know, what do we do about this? Well, this gets back to the problem of identity. And that is that you're... You know, you are who you are, but here's the deal. You're not sure who you are. You don't know, you know, whether or not you might, if you ever surfed, that you might love surfing. You have no idea, okay? Not if you've never done it. If you've never played ping pong, you wouldn't know whether or not you would really like it. You might not. You might. So your life is the process of self-discovery. And the way you do self-discovery is you take chances, be exposed to new things, try things out, and find out. And you can estimate whether or not you might like something, but you can't know for sure. You just can't. I just had this happen to me, by the way. My unbelievable, not open, great friend, Dr. Alan Goldhammer, and I, the two of us, are unbelievably not open. Okay, so, but he had the... A brilliant idea. He said, okay, we just had a little work break we took to Santa Barbara a few days ago. And so we went down there so that I could work on my new book. And Alan could answer 1,000 emails. And so we went down there. And the thing was to do something new. And that something new was surfing. So we both grew up in Southern California, basically on the beach, and had never surfed. Why? Too nerdy, not open, too geeky, and we were not the cool kids. And so we just weren't going to do anything cool like that. So I was on the math team. Okay, that's how it went. All right. So he says, let's get a surfing lesson. So Moneybags Goldhammer pays for a surfing lesson. What's that?
He suggested this?
Yeah, he did.
That's cool.
So give him credit, okay? So we go down there, and of course I'm expecting to freeze to death and that I'm going to hate it. But I'm like, I'm not going to let him be more open than me. So I'm going to like, oh, yeah, sure, okay, I'm up for it. So we go down there, and of course who meets us at the beach? The guy in his funky truck is this really cool, good-looking, you know, 35-year-old guy named Kevin, who absolutely is like right out of central casting for a surfer. Now, he was smarter than the average surfer, so he didn't talk like a valley girl. He was actually a UC Santa Barbara graduate, and so, but he was a surfer dude, and he was very cool. And we put on wetsuits, And I had never put on a wetsuit. I went in the water. I couldn't believe it. It's unbelievably nice. And it was the morning. It was beautiful out. And I fully expected to be freezing to death in that water and that I would hate every minute of it. And Alan and I looked at each other and said, hey, this is pretty nice. We liked it. And believe me, we were incredibly incompetent. We were exhausted at the end of, 40 minutes in the water. Alan got up on his board pretty good. He got up on his board. I lasted, I think my longest ride was 0.7 seconds, and I was diving into the water. I could not stay on that board. Alan could actually stay on it. So that was it. Great. We're going to do it again. Identity. We had no idea that this would have been part of our identity. We just took a shot at it here late in life, and we discovered something new. The problem of opening up a marriage and opening up any serious pair bond relationship, dealing with the possible problems that would result from this. We have to look at the upside. We have to look at the downside. There has to be open discussions about this. And we have to take our time and run the smallest possible experiments. Okay, notice that I didn't go out in the deep water and, surf the big curl. Okay, no. We go on the 2-foot waves with somebody that knows what they're doing on a picture perfect day, with a mild breeze. That's what we do. Safe, tiny little steps, no, the minimal possible stress and hurt. That's what we do. So, if someone really wants to do this, you go to a swingers party where you stay fully clothed and everybody doesn't do, the agreement is we're doing nothing. We're just here to watch. Okay? And heck, we might do that 6 or 8 times and never do anything. We see who can stick their toe in the water and who can't stick their toe in the water or what circumstances people might want, et cetera. And we find out how much hurt is this causing to the partner? What is it that they are thinking or feeling? Where are we at? And tiny decision by tiny decision, we find out where we are. Okay? And then we make the smallest possible decisions that we can make. If we got a situation where we've got a lifetime-like partner that says, no, I can't imagine ever having you do that, and if you ever had a relationship outside, it would bother me so much and I'd obsess about it, and I don't know that I could ever forgive you. Well, then you better think about that. Okay, so that's one of these deals where we have to have the philosophical understanding that life is inherently what we're going to call tragic. And that doesn't mean it's a tragedy, and that doesn't mean it's miserable. It means this is the correct view of the nature of existence, is that it is tragic. And the tragedy is that there are conflicts of interest which are difficult. Okay? Everybody I meet is always about back to nature, and everything's going to be cool, and we're all going to live in harmony. You got to be kidding me. Everything in nature is in conflict, okay? Nature is laden with brutal conflict all over the world. It's predator-prey. That's what it is. It's eat or be eaten. That's what it is. So this is, the fact that human life has some difficult choices and that those choices can be, that there can be significant consequences on the sides of those choices. What we can do is we can try to optimize the conflicts of interest as humans as best we can with open discussion, tiny, tiny little decisions. We try to do this as best we can, okay? And if it turns out that that our identities as a pair of people are such that we have some very significant sacrifices that have to be made by one party in order for the other party to be okay, then it turns out that then you have to horse trade as much as you can, and you have to, the communication about what those sacrifices mean. If let's suppose the husband has to sacrifice his desire for novelty and variety because the female just cannot possibly handle, that. It's just not something that she could sit with. Well, then we're going to have to horse trade it elsewhere, okay? So there's going to be things that she needs to understand that this is a characteristic of hers that he's going to honor, but she's going to have to go more than halfway in other things, and vice versa. Okay, so that's the best we can do with this, and that's the nature of life.
Fascinating. That went way deeper than I expected, and I love it.
Yeah, all good. And me too.
All right, so Dr. Lyle, I'm thinking maybe next time you go out surfing, we get a photographer and help add to that your dating profile on Match.com.
No, I don't think so. Besides,
I'm picturing this. Your wetsuit halfway off, so we show your chest and your arms, and you're kind of like looking out in the sunrise with Alan like staring you down, and you're just like have the surfboard under your arms, and
Yeah,
can see it already.
A lot of Photoshop. You got to get somebody that's really good at Photoshop. All right, let's go on.
All right. Well, we got a caller on hold, but I want you to let's do this one question, and then we'll take the caller.
Yeah.
So caller, stay on hold, and we'll get to you in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Dr. Lyle, and speaking of which, dating profiles, Dr. Lyle, I'm looking for a long-term pair bond with an amazing man. From listening to your show, I have a much better understanding about the evolutionary psychology of the dating world. Having been a subject of countless casual mating scenarios, I have a question about what you would suggest writing in my online dating profile that would weed out the wrong men and attract the right man. I'm looking for someone that'll stick around past the 10 paid dates, really wants to do life with me, and who's happy and willing to share resources. What can I say in my profile to make this clear to potential partners and only attract men that are truly interested?
Well, I don't think this is that difficult. It's a very interesting question. I don't think it's difficult at all to answer. I think that you would dress conservatively in your profile, and if you meet the person, you'd act conservatively. You'd use 10 paid dates, obviously. You would explain in your profile your vision of the future. So you would be looking, you know, deep into the future about things that interest you in life and how you want your life to look. And let me give you a cheesy example. I could really see myself with some partner that I'd just be crazy about into our old age and on a rocking chair somewhere on a nice, you know, overlooking a beautiful spot. Yeah. What did you just tell everybody? Okay.
That you read romance
novels. Long-term pair bond. Okay, so this is what we're talking about. So, or, you know, I'm really looking for a lifetime partner. Okay, or I'm looking for, you know, that's coming out with a sledgehammer, but you can talk this type of way, and it becomes abundantly clear to anybody looking at this that this is absolutely pair bond chick. Okay, so there's no casual mating indication anywhere in sight. Another thing is to be honest in your descriptions of who you are on the Big Five. So, you know, how do you do that? You know, I don't know. Your music, your interests, you know, what you find pleasing in life and what are the things that are that you like to do. You're trying to give them an honest description of kind of who it is that you are on those regards. But the most important thing is that in your description of what it is that you, what your future, you know, you could talk about things that you like and what you like to do and what you find interesting in the world and things that you've read that were cool. And then we're going to talk about how, you know, in your future you would like to, you're really hoping to find, you know, the one great person to, you know, have a lifetime adventure. Talk that way, and everybody knows what that means. And so, no problem. Then if they're willing to run that gauntlet behind your nicely but conservatively displayed photography, and those prose, and then you act conservatively when you meet them, okay, and then you're withholding through 3, 4, 5, 6 dates. Well, trust me, if we get that far, we're talking about somebody who's very interested and is interested in a long-term partnership. Okay, so we fish from that pool and we do the best we can. That's how you do it.
Fantastic. Dr. Lai, do you recommend women going on those like little dinner dates or things like that before things get intimate with multiple men? For example, you know, you got two or three men messaging you on Match.com saying, hey, you want to go out to dinner. Would you go on a first date with all of them or kind of stick with one, go to three or four dates with them, see if you like them or not, and then move on to the second?
I mean, there could be circumstances, I suppose, that you could have depends upon how popular the girl is, and whether or not, you know, what it is that her advertisements look like. You know, this all has to do with market share and circumstances and everything else under the sun. It's certainly possible that somebody that was really committed and busy could have three or four dates in a week, and for three or four first dates in a week. There's no reason under the sun to not have three or four first dates in a week. You get a look at these people and they get a look at you, whether it's a half an hour, an hour, or 2 hours, whatever it is that you're comfortable with. There's going to be people we would think that you're throwing back in the pool even after day one. And there's going to be people that aren't interested in you after day one. So, yeah, there's no problem. I think it's sort of obvious that if you're still interested by date four, date five, you're probably not that interested in meeting new people. This is a sort of a natural market phenomenon that, you're not usually juggling too much at once unless what you're juggling isn't very interesting. As soon as you get very interested, you know, your life gets simpler.
Very, very cool. Okay.
All right.
Well, let's take our caller. Well, right as we take our caller, the caller hangs up. All right.
Yeah, there you go. Fair enough. Yeah,
perfect timing. All right, Dr. Lyle, I think we'll end there. We got an interesting show next week about guessing the personality based on facial cues and hormonal cues. So looking forward to that.
Very good. All right. We'll see you all next week.
Very good. Have a good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.